to express our support, the union's support, for the action that Westminster is taking today. The teach-in specifically and all the actions related to requesting information of the administration about the proposed sale of Westminster. Since the time Ryder announced very abruptly its decision to find a partner for Westminster, the union has had many concerns about the potential sale. Starting from the abrupt announcement, going on to not including faculty and student voices in the decision-making and the whole proceeding. Some of our concerns include the lack of necessity for such a sale. In the negotiating season we had this summer, we requested financial data from the institution, which they provided. It was all extremely positive. Yes, there are costs for the kind of instruction that Westminster offers to ensure its quality. You know what else has costs? Science instruction. Maintaining state-of-the-art laboratories is not free, and I would say that that is a good investment as well. And Ryder has chosen to expand in that area. Do you know what discipline doesn't cost a lot of money? Philosophy. Once you get rid of the faculty salary cost, it really is only chalk and a chalkboard. That's all you need to teach philosophy. But Ryder is not interested in investing that, which I would argue would be a good investment. How do you have a university without a philosophy department, without a philosophy major? It was the first discipline. I do not mean to imply that there aren't challenges, but from a fiscal standpoint, Westminster has been doing very well, meeting enrollment goals, maintaining our students at a higher rate than the other campus, and with a good endowment for about 40% of the overall institution's endowment, with about only a 10% student ratio. So that's pretty good. Beyond the fact that selling Westminster is not a real fiscal necessity, we are concerned about the precedent of selling an institution of higher learning to a for-profit entity. The purpose of a for-profit entity is right there in its name. It exists to make a profit. We are a not-for-profit, which means that all of your money that goes here goes toward programs at Westminster, towards the faculty, towards the facilities, towards the staff. A for-profit institution exists to make profit over and above its cost. What we can say we do when we take money is in the service of your education. What will a for-profit entity do? The claim is that they want to run this as a not-for-profit, but if we're under the umbrella of a for-profit, doesn't that mean that some of the student money, your tuition money, that you pay for educational programming will go toward a shareholder who has no role in your education? We worry about things like that. Your money going to people who do not have a stake in your education. Their stake is in the profit part. We worry that faculty will have to tolerate less compensation for the wonderful work we do because the university will now need to make a profit. Right now, when there's extra money, there are no shareholders who get that money. It gets put back into the institution for future programs, for future endeavors. Now, the cost of higher education is ever present in today's news. You just open a newspaper, you will find something about how expensive it is. And of course, that's not news to you. You see your bill, right? We all know how it is, and we are aware. We faculty are aware. Some of us have children we send to college or have sent to college. We are very aware of this. But we're not convinced that selling a not-for-profit institution to a for-profit institution is a way to alleviate these problems when there are other solutions, like increased fundraising. Finally, the AUP is opposed to the manner in which faculty is disenfranchised in both the decision to sell Westminster and in the subsequent steps to ensure a buyer. Over the summer negotiations, on a topic related to how university proposals would change the nature of our institution, the administration made clear that they had appointed themselves the arbiter of what Ryder should be. Faculty voices should be consulted, but they did not need to be heeded. The AUP believes in shared governance. This includes a robust democratic discussion about the nature of what the institution is and what it should be moving forward into the future. In this way, we create a shared vision of what our institution is that we can all enact. The administration seems to see faculty as nuisances to be tolerated and a drain on resources that should be curtailed, while it sees students as revenue streams. Such an attitude is counter to our vision of higher education, which sees faculty and students at the center of the mission and the real stakeholders of the future of the institution. Thank you.
Countless people in this country and throughout the world who have encountered our alumni as conductors, professional singers, teachers, pianists, organists, and composers. Over all these years, I've also seen several times when our future seemed bleak and uncertain. Reading about the history of the school before I got here in the late 1950s, early 60s, when our founder, John Finley Williamson, was retiring and leaving, that was a time when enrollment dropped and there was a real possibility that the school would not go on losing its founder. Fortunately, a prominent Princeton businessman and musician, Lee Hastings Crystal, took over and then brought the school into the new century and made very important changes in the curriculum and programs that were needed to make sure our graduates competed in the profession. During my sophomore year, Dr. Bristol announced he was leaving. So we were very upset at that point, very much similar to probably the way many of you feel. I think during those times, the word stress Mr. Choir College was the best. Also, he announced that early in the year, towards the end of the year, our director of choral activities, Dr. George Lynn, who was a link back to John Philly Williamson, also decided to leave. So we were losing two very important people. And so the future, we weren't worried about closing at that moment, but we were worried that the programs that we came to Westminster for would continue. While those 2 years were rocky, the school continued under its then president, Ray Robinson. And when I came back as a grad student in the mid-70s, the school was thriving. It was a very exciting time in Westminster's history. There were new faculty, new degree programs. Joe Flummerfelt was our new director of choral activities. Recording contracts with the choir continued. We started our affiliation with the Spoleto Festival, first in Italy, and then also now in Charleston, which we still have. It was very exciting. I left here then to continue my voice studies at Indiana University and start my second career as a voice teacher and singer. And I returned here in the early 80s. In a few years, it was evident that something else was going on. Enrollment started dropping due to a change in the demographics, which was not prepared for by the administration. And it's very ironic to me that part of Rider's perceived financial difficulties stems from also the same issue, demographics. It annoys me when I keep reading that they have lost 1,000 students. I'd like to tell them that those 1,000 students have not been born. That's why they're not here. There are not that many 18-year-olds. But things got really bad then, and Westminster really faced closing the doors. Literally at the ninth hour, the then Ryder College and its president, Bart Ludeke, and the Board of Trustees made a very bold decision to save us and take over the college and its programs. They made big investments in repairing buildings and grounds, which had been neglected over the years. And personally, I will always be grateful to Rider University, and especially its faculty, for saving us. We would not be in this room right now if it wasn't for Rider University. And I know that was a bold move. I know there were many faculty here that were not so happy about that decision, because they knew they would have to divert some of the money to this campus, money that probably couldn't be used for programs on that campus. And so I think if I were a faculty member there, I might have been upset too. But 26 years later, we are still here. We have had wonderful relationships with many of our colleagues there, especially with the formation of the Westminster College of the Arts, has been a boon to the school. Now, when some people think of musicians, some people, of course no one here, they picture temperamental divas, devos, egotistical conductors, and performers. So we know these people may exist, but the majority of musicians that we know that music is a collaborative art. It's a rare time when you're standing up totally alone making music. You're either a singer with a pianist with a singer, a conductor with a choir member with other members of your section and choir. Collaboration is in a musician's DNA. So I stand here today with my colleagues to urge the president and board of trustees to involve us in this process. We need to know who we will be collaborating with and are eager to contribute. The stress level in the faculty, not knowing whether or not we're having jobs for the future, the stress level in the student body, where you should all be really focusing in on your studies and not worrying about what you read on Facebook is true or false, and the staff, which has seen tremendous cuts, both in positions not being filled, adding to the workload of the current staff, and they have had drastic cuts to their medical benefits, retirement, and their wages frozen longer than the faculty has. This has to stop now. One final thought. I had a conversation a few years ago with our dear department colleague, Lindsay Christensen, and I had to figure out a way of getting her in this. We were talking, I think it was after a concert, about how lucky we were to be on the faculty of this school. And I remember saying, you know, Lindsay, I just knowing what Westminster has been through and how crazy things are here financially, it is amazing we're still open, that we are still here and operating. And she looked at me and she relayed to me a conversation she had with Westminster donor and supporter, William Scheide, who's the student center's named after, and she said to me, "Tom, you know what Bill Scheide says about Westminster? The best thing Westminster does is survive." So we will survive. Thank you.
Concert is the norm here. We listen to one another, we fight with one another, we dream together, we build programs together. I've had the great good fortune to have worked with some of the most wonderful solo and choral singers, educators, choral conductors, arts administrators in their role as voice teacher for 32 years now. Many have gone on to great success that reflects immediately on Westminster. You are surrounded by great music making. Our choirs have sung with every important conductor in the Western world, and I personally have witnessed rehearsals on our campus with Bernstein, Robert Shaw, Zubin Mehta, Rostropovich, Ricardo Muti, among others. Music making at the highest level happens here, and I credit this place for forming the musician and teacher that I am today. I was only 29 years old when I started teaching here. You do the math. And up to this point, I was only exposed to operatic literature, not as much the great song works and choral literature. I soaked it all in and want to continue to grow and learn as a teacher here in Princeton. My growth as a teacher could not have happened anywhere else. Encouraging, demanding, and inspirational colleagues and students working together is what we want to continue to be. Thank you.
Have American universities lost their way? I believe they have, ours in particular. But on what basis can I make such a provocative statement? There are many reasons, but today I will focus on only one. It has to do with the fundamental nature of university business. There are two types of enterprises, for-profit and not-for-profit. For-profits are owned, and as their name states, operated to benefit their owners and shareholders financially. For-profits pay taxes. Not-for-profits are owned by no one. Let that sink in. No one owns this university. No one owns Westminster. There are no shareholders, only stakeholders. Students, parents, alumni, faculty, staff, and friends. Not-for-profits do not exist to produce financial benefit for any individual. Instead, they create what is called a public good. Until recently, it seemed obvious education was a public good. After all, education is the foundation of democracy and the basis for the prosperity and well-being of a nation's citizens. Society considers the idea of public goods so significant, not-for-profits are tax-exempt. Not-for-profits cannot be bought or sold. Only their assets can. But President DeLomo put Westminster up for sale, so he must consider Westminster to be merely an asset. And the president has found a buyer, a for-profit corporation, an entity that has no experience in higher education. The person responsible for the stewardship of our beloved college claims such an organization is well positioned to lead Westminster into the future. But we're told the for-profit won't run Westminster. The buyer will create a not-for-profit corporation. So everything's cool, right? Not if you read the news. In recent years, the for-profit education industry soared but ran into difficulty once the public understood its tactics left hundreds of thousands of students with staggering debt and little to show for it. The government cracked down on the industry to such an extent it began to develop a new strategy, conversion to not-for-profit. The most famous conversion to date is that of Kaiser University. In June, David Halperin wrote, "In 2011, the Kaiser family sold Kaiser University for $521 million to a small nonprofit organization, Everglades College, which the Kaisers had created. In order to buy Kaiser University, Everglades took on a $321 million loan, a loan made by Arthur Kaiser.
The nonprofit he created is thus paying him principal and interest on that loan, plus an annual salary as chancellor and CEO of Kaiser University of $831,000. Kaiser also made Everglades a charitable gift of much of the rest of the purchase price, potentially providing him with large tax deductions. In addition, Arthur Kaiser owns stakes in properties that collect some $14.6 million in rent from Everglades. He owns stakes in the Holiday Inn where Everglades employees stay, in a private airplane that Everglades employees use, and in a computer company that contracts with a college. Several board members of the nonprofit Everglades also have had business deals with the school for its filing system, for recruiting services, for the school's pool maintenance program. The chairman of their board is CEO of Best Roofing, which boasts on its website that it assists Kaiser with all their roofing decisions and adds an endorsement from Art Kaiser himself. Incidentally, Arthur Kaiser is now the new chair of the United States Department of Education's National Advisory Committee on Institutional Quality and Integrity, the group of experts charged with advising the department on the performance of college accrediting organizations. It seems an inappropriate conflict of interest for any current college operator with a financial stake in a college to sit as a member of the Department of Education committee that evaluates the fitness of accreditors, who in turn evaluate the fitness of the operator's college. But it looks even worse, he writes, and it is even worse if the operator's college has a troubling record, in that case, two fraud charges. The operator is awaiting a major ruling on its future from the Department of Education, and the operator is elevated to chairman of the committee that makes those decisions. But surely our situation can't be corrupt like that, can it? Isn't it possible this really is a great opportunity for Westminster? We cannot know, because the stakeholders in our not-for-profit have not been part of the decision-making. On repeated occasions, President DeLomo has regaled us in excited tones that this transaction is, quote, virgin territory, a, quote, seminal event unprecedented in higher education. Putting aside his language of exploitation, if it's unprecedented, then he is setting the precedent, right? And DeLomo's precedent has been to ignore the stakeholders. His precedent has been to make a personal decision with regard to programs, lives, and culture of our institution. And he's made this decision in the dark. We are Westminster, and we deserve to be part of the decisions that affect our futures. Our voices deserve to be heard. DeLomo's mode of operation is actually common in the world of for-profits, and as the education industry becomes corporatized, we see less and less focus on public good and more emphasis on private good. 2 years ago, when the president and provost fired tenured faculty and eliminated majors and minors that weren't profitable, things like fine art and philosophy, for example, these people were prepared to lead a university without art and philosophy. As shocking as that was, perhaps we shouldn't have been surprised they would also try to get rid of us. Last March, the writer SGA questioned the wisdom of this administration's plan. Quote, with this loss, the university has identified retaining world-class artistic programs as the least of its priorities. Quote. Recently, the provost claimed accounting was the university's best program. Our accounting program is excellent, I thought. But you mean after Westminster, right? No, the misunderstanding was mine. When she said best, she meant most profitable. The university makes more money per capita on accounting majors than on any other program. The university's academic leader equated best with profitable, not with a program that produces the greatest public good. But we are Westminster, the program that creates the greatest public good. We develop the world's musical leaders. Every day, our graduates demonstrate their leadership in schools, places of worship, concert halls, their communities, private lessons, and through acts of creation. Their actions enrich the lives of millions of people worldwide every day. But our graduates know that leadership is not simply the assertion of one's authority. It isn't something that flows top down from a superior to subordinates. True leaders recognize that leadership is a form of service. Leadership is not about standing above, but alongside. Our leaders have lost their way, but Westminster has not. Today, we stand alongside one another, ready to lead. We are Westminster. Hear our voices. To create a magical moment. Following that Lutkin, we'll go out into the yard. Some of you have some signs. Perhaps you want to carry them with you. And we can have a little activity outside as well. Dr. Jordan.